Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is a subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks.
Do you ever get tired of being Brittany? And she just sort of looked at him, and then the next question. And I put my hand up and said, you said that you were doing a film about being in an intense relationship. Are you in an intense relationship now? And she said, no. And then that went around the world and she split up with Justin.
That was you?
Yeah, that was me.
That was you.
Brilliant.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Hacks and Flacks. And this one, we are diving headfirst into the world of celebrity PR and how it fits in the current news landscape. And to explain what all that actually means, I'm joined by an expert panel from the world of news. Hello, Mick Booker.
Hi.
And public relations, or PR as it's known, with Andrew McDougall.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. And special guest, Richard Dawes.
Hello.
Hello. Richard, welcome to the show. Whilst Andrew works in the field of political PR, you look after some of the world's biggest names in music. You're going to have to drop a few names for us.
I don't like doing this.
Oh, come on.
It just sounds terrible.
I can do it for you.
Nah, okay. Yeah, well,
as your PR.
Yeah, please, actually. It sounds better. Brit Awards. We do Elton John. We do Harry Styles. Dua Lipa. Craig David. Paloma Faith. Holly Willoughby, about 70 others who kind of are similar ilk.
Wow.
So, what a show.
Yeah. See, I told you.
when you're the best, you don't know.
You didn't immediately start working with those huge names. So how did you climb that greasy pole?
I was working for a record company, Universal. My friend Stuart Bell contacted me and said, what do you think? Should we do something? We started our company. And just the two of us. He was working with Paul McCartney at the time. Paul McCartney came with us. I was doing Take That at the time. Take That came with us. And we took it from there. And now there's 40 people working for us.
Wow. I mean, that it's something. But you've got names like Take That and McCartney. I mean, they're
it helped.
That's pretty good,
bit.
Isn't it? It's pretty good.
We won the Brit Awards the following year. And again, we didn't have a clue we'd be able to do that. And there was, I think there were three or four of us at the time. And we had to quickly staff up to be able to do the Brits. And we've been doing the Brits ever since, so 13 years.
That's always my favorite part of PR, when you're bidding for work and you're like, we could totally do this. We're never going to get this, but we could totally do it if we get it. And then you're like, shit, we got it.
Oh, no.
We've got
to get a lanyard budget now.
And then your client's like, why are you advertising all over the place for jobs all of a sudden? You're like, no reason. Don't worry. You'll be taken care of.
See, I remember Stuart when I first came down to London, and he was waiting for, is it outside? Outside organization? Right, yeah. And you could tell the good guys from the start, because I was, you know, I didn't know anyone from Adam down here in terms of PR. But obviously I was working on the Star and I'd not been there a few weeks. And the first thing I'm doing is talking to celebrity agents, and I met someone like Stuart, and he was brilliant. And it was just a case of you get a good relationship with the people from an early age and you try and stick it through. I mean, obviously I've still never had an interview with Paul McCartney off of either of them, but still I will get one.
You're
eventually.
Not bitter. You're not bitter.
You promised you wouldn't do this, Mick.
We saved the best till last.
They're not going to come back.
But to that point, Mick, is it an old school tie thing then? Is it an old boys' network in terms of those relationships those relationships?
That's the difference with, someone like Stuart and Richard. They're not like that. And there was a lot in those days that there were the old school PRs. You know, you scratch my back, you know, I'll scratch yours sort of thing. in my relationship with Stuart particularly, it was a case of he took me at face value, I took him at face value, and we got on. But I could see that he treated everyone equally. And there's not many people who do that. And I think that's why people like these two get a good reputation, because otherwise you'll get shot down these days. And they've kept on going. They've built up great relationships with a lot of people. I mean, it's obviously a good start to start with two of the biggest bands from two different eras. But still, people will only stick with you if you do a good job for them. And these guys do a good job. Well, there's a lot of cowboys out there.
Richard, a totally symbiotic relationship then between PR and press.
Yeah, I think just listen to what Mick was saying about the way things used to be done. I think I noticed a lot about, or I'd hear stories of PRs who were doing a bit of a favour for a favour. You know, they'd say, look, I will give you this act or artist if you'll do something on my new act, something like that. And I never used to get that. I always thought, God, I wish I could do that. But actually, you realise that you really just want to foster a really good relationship where you can make sure you have a fantastic experience doing something that the media get what they want and you get what you want. And then everyone walks away happy. And you don't have to owe people something down the line or saying, you know what, we gave you that front cover and you said you'd sort this or whatever. You know, I never wanted to get into that. I just wanted to do something that everyone won. And you've got
and that's respect for your clients as well, isn't it? It's not because, again, a lot of the old school ones looked as though they didn't like their clients and so treated them like a big piece of meat. Whereas, again, if you did that these days, you know, Elton's not going to like that, is he?
I mean, you want to know that you're doing this and you're getting it on the basis of merit, right? I don't think anybody wants to feel that they're only getting something because somebody owed you a favor, you know, especially if you put your heart into something. Whether that's politics or art, you want people to take the art at face value. And if they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. And you wouldn't want to feel ever that somebody's only giving you the time of day because they look up the ladder and say, well, if I give this artist I've never heard of a nice review, maybe Harry Styles will come talk to me. And I'm sure people think like that. But on the PR side, you do your client no favor if you indulge and lean into that. See, hey, you don't want a hostage to fortune. And you don't want to be over the barrel, making somebody that you represent do something that you don't think they should do because it gets you out of a jam. Like, that is death.
Coming to that point, Richard, when you first take on a client, I mean, is it that you would sit them down and say, right, expose every skeleton in your closet now, tell me where all, you know, the bodies are buried, so to speak, so that you know what you're PRing. You don't want any surprises. What is that first conversation like?
It depends who it is. I mean, I was saying to someone earlier that we don't market ourselves as a crisis PR company, so we don't really have a sort of situation where we have to say, right, spill the beans. We take people on because we value their art and we respect them and we're excited by what they're doing in the world. And if they make a mistake, we're there to be able to help them out with that situation. So if we were taking on a new client, usually if they felt there was something that needed to be said, we would have a session where we say, okay, what's going on in your world? What have you got coming up? Anything we should know? And that's usually sufficient to be able to give us what we know, what we need to know. But yeah, we wouldn't have a kind of, right, come on, where are the skeletons? What's happening? You know, we just don't work with those sort of clients that would need to do that. I think, just like I said, some kind of getting to know what's going on, what's on the lay of the land is usually just part of what we do.
Is there plenty of times though when they are giving you the lay of the land of what's going on in their world that you've listened to it and then said, well, actually, we can't work with you? Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, absolutely.
And is it because of...
And more and more now, just thinking of our staff and how the values that we have as a company and whether we represent someone that we feel has the same values. And we have to think about that a lot as well. You know, the world's changing a lot. You know, we have had a few people say, see you having a conversation with them, I'm not sure. Hasn't happened a lot, but we've definitely had to think carefully about.
Is that a worry? I know you say you've got morals and values and but is it a case of these days there is that worry, and even in PR companies, that even if you take on someone, then that toxicity shuts you down as well if they get shut down?
Yeah, I read this. I'm not going to claim it as my own, but I read this when we were dealing with a crisis early on in Doorbell's lifetime, and it was about elasticity around reputation. And the idea is, if you pay into the bank of goodwill regularly, then you have a lot more elastic to your reputation. So, you know, somebody is known as being a bit of a bad a bad guy does something bad, then it's like, oh, they deserved it. Mm. And it's harder to come back from that. Whereas if it's somebody who's somebody good, they've got good values, etc., they make a mistake, you're more likely to be believed as kind of like, you know, there was a mishap. You know, let's give them a break. Let's give them a chance. This is why we don't sort of put us in the, ourselves in the mix with the people that we kind of think maybe don't.
But Richard, even if you don't put yourself in the mix, people have somebody you think is a good guy. Even good guys have bad days. So how do you PR that?
Well, like I said, I think, you know, situations pop up and you get all the facts, work out what's going on, and then you try to make sure that the truth and, you know, that the story is being authentically told. And I think in those sort of situations, our job is to make sure that we're working with the media to make sure that what they're reporting is as accurate as it is. We're not trying to pull wool over anyone's eyes and say something that didn't happen did. We're trying to make sure that they're not reporting it the wrong way.
People on the other side of these things have motives as well, too. So it's, you know, often we'll get approached and something just sounds like a good story. And so they bring it to you. And when you actually work it through with them, they can see that it's not a great story. But that takes engagement. This is getting back to the point about you deal with the good people. For me, and I imagine it is for you, it is that ability to have that relationship. And not just like through electronic devices, but actually have sat across tables from these people so they can look you in the eye and know that if I am telling you that this is not what you think it is, you will trust me.
Yeah.
Because of course I would say that. And that's where when you're in our line of work, the only thing you do have really at the end of the day is that. You know, sure, you have your connections in your network, but they need to know that if you're telling them something, like the second we lie to someone, pick a scenario, any scenario, and even if our client has done something wrong, we will never lie about that because that gets you out of one jam once. But if the cost of that is destroying your reputation, then you've not served anybody. So you have to take that in. And the people that last a long time in this game, in my experience, they're either complete bastards and they use every tool to kind of shut down legitimate inquiry. Mm-hmm. Or they're just people who know how to relate to people and sit across the table from people and pick up a phone and talk to a person and know that you will get the truth.
Going back to the old generation, there was all they had to deal with was a limited bunch of newspapers effectively every day, be mates with a couple of the editors, and then that was it. You know, they had their little cabal. Whereas now, media is so mass, you know, it's unquantifiable, isn't it? So you've got to deal with so many different people all the time that you can't just have those closed off relationships, give every interview to, you know, the son or whatever it is. And so you've got to broaden it. You've got to be a nice person.
The other thing, though, is it's not just the media now, is it? It's self-promotion that your clients might make. It might be Twitter. How do you control that? What's your advice that you give to your clients about tweeting stuff that may seem to be nothing but then can blow up?
Check with us first.
Every single tweet?
No, I mean, when you're working in rock and roll, let's say, you know, you want people to be themselves. So, you know, ultimately, you know, most of our clients will go off and they'll do what they do. But I think they've sat with us enough times where we sort of sit on their shoulder as the sort of the angel, I'd like to say, rather than devil, saying, are you sure you want to be writing that? But obviously, you know, sometimes you do get a client tweeting something that you think, okay, you know,
we need to handle that.
But you handle it in the same way that you handle any sort of situation. Is there an explanation? Is there a background? Is there context? Is there, you know, I'm a great believer in an apology, but not just an apology, but an honest, authentic apology that goes far enough as well.
Has Twitter become a bane for you? Is that one of the issues that you would
say? The only reason Twitter's become a bane, I think, more so is the response rather than the actual the conduit for an artist to say something wrong or say something that would be deemed as offensive, say. It's more the kind of the Twitter sphere that kind of piles in when you have a story. And also the media's, suddenly you've got this realm that kind of feeds stories. You know, you've got an opportunity, oh, Twitter said this about this particular situation. That's a story now.
Yeah.
It's not like the story itself. It's actually that this is what Twitter said, or three people on Twitter said a lot of the time. And that's hard.
Three random people who often aren't even named does not make a news story.
It does if you need a news story around about on a Sunday newspaper about 6 o'clock at night on a Saturday afternoon.
See episodes
that
pass
is a news story now.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, and the other thing, I don't think people realize the impact of the incoming or the inbound, whether it's on artists or politicians or corporates even. And it is ruinous for them to spend their time kind of sifting through this nightmare. And, you know, you can treat it as a broadcast medium to say what you want to say, even if it's in a sticky situation. Now you have the ability to go to camera and put out exactly what you want to put out, and then let that go. But the second you start dwelling in the replies, like, you know, like why a young footballer or a young artist would put so much stock into what people who don't know them think. And I guess that's the double edge of celebrity, is that you rely on that because you by definition can't know everybody that thinks you're great.
But it's horrible.
But what other universe
do
people who hate you follow? You know, that's the thing. It's like, you know, if I pay my Spotify subscription, I listen to you, I make an active choice because I don't hate listen to you. But on these platforms, I will chuck a comment of, like, if I don't like Harry Styles, I'll tell Harry Styles I don't like Harry Styles. Like, why do I waste my time doing that? That's a great question. Why should an artist care about that? Don't let them see it. You do you. And this is where, like, the stoic in me comes through, is that all you can control is what you put into the world. You have to stop caring about what comes back. Because if you rely on the what comes back, you're not doing it for the right reason.
That famous quote that's misattributed to Aristotle, which is, if you want to avoid criticism, say nothing, be nothing, do nothing.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually how I've told that to a couple of artists who have gone like, actually, God, that really makes sense. Mm. Because we're not doing it for them. No. You know, we're doing it for us, and you've got to remember that. And I think the value of the PR is also in understanding getting the truth out of the situation and not letting the melee that ensues take over, and to actually go, hold on a minute, just let this die for a second and then you'll see where it's going, rather than, or actually no, this really does need to be addressed very quickly. You know, knowing the difference between something that is just getting a little bit of hate for the sake of hate and something that is a problem. And I think that's where, you know, I think it's a good PR comes in.
Has something like Leveson since then, has that meant that newspapers aren't as much of a problem for you in terms of stuff?
I think there's still, newspapers are still driving the narrative and are still driving the news. I know they're also reacting to the news as well a lot. Yeah. And I think there's still that importance from that point of view at 100%, which is why we still have those relationships and we still prioritize. And also, if you think about a lot of these, we're talking about social media and Twitter earlier, and some of the clients out there in entertainment world have huge followings, you know, huge audiences. Mm. But that's in a vacuum. You know, you still need to be engaging outside of that.
In terms of the journalists who actually ring you up, is it still mainly newspapers?
A mixture. There's a lot of online now as well. Mm. You've got a lot of these platforms like Lad Bible, who have got huge amounts of engagement in audiences and are important. There's obviously areas which are, when you talked earlier about sort of broadcasting, because you've got a few titles that can do a lot. Mm. Now you've got something which Stu likes to call narrowcasting, I think it's been used, where you're choosing a lot of little places to be able to get across your story. And so we have to know all those little places to be able to get the right thing across.
On Stuart should be arrested for making up a word like that.
I know, yeah. I agree.
Yeah, but it's all bad about PR. I'm walking out.
But on the audience point, it is like the scale of the audiences, I don't think people conceive. If you think of newspapers at their peak, might have had 4.5 million maybe at the peak. And these artists, not even ones that you've heard of, will have many multiples of that. And that, I mean, when I worked for Stephen Harper, we had this one moment where it was the Queen's, one of her jubilees, and we had all these medals to give up to prominent Canadians. And so Justin Bieber was coming to town one day.
You've only got one prominent Canadian, that's it.
Well, no, Shania Twain, Arcade Fire. We have many, many.
Oh, yeah,
don't don't make me start defending. And don't make me bring the moose and maple syrup.
The family of mooses as well, yeah.
And so anyway, so the Prime Minister's daughter was a believer.
Right.
As I think they were known at the time. So he's like, well, why don't we give one of these to him? And so we were tasked with finding Scooter Braun, his agent, and getting in contact. And Justin Bieber was honored to get a Jubilee medal. Only trouble was he showed up. Prime Minister showed up in a suit. Justin Bieber showed up in overalls with one strap undone. So we actually couldn't find a place to pin the medal on. It was quite awkward. But they let us take a picture. Right. And so anyway, we tweeted it, and Justin Bieber retweeted it and started getting in shit because he was wearing overalls to meet the Prime Minister. And he started getting this dog pile of hate. And so I remember this moment, clear as day. I'm out for dinner on a Saturday night. I had the Prime Minister's wife call me going, poor Justin Bieber's getting beat up online. What are we going to do about it? because he had just made like LOLs, you know, overalls. And Prime Minister's wife was like, we got to say something about this. I'm having my dinner. It's Saturday night, but this is the life of PR. Am I right? And I'm like, okay, we can't be serious because that would be boring. And so we ended up, the Prime Minister ended up tweeting back, quoting the tweet and going, to be fair, I told Justin I'd show up in my overalls too. He retweeted it. His however many tens of millions of all pile into that. Suddenly we're in the Hollywood Reporter. We're in all these outlets. And the skills, it will be, I think, to this day, the most retweeted tweet certainly that Prime Minister has ever had. But it just shows you this universe and these pockets that you're talking about, narrow cubby. For a politician, it works the other way. We tapped into this amazing place that no politician goes in. And that's the joy of these platforms now, is that you can do it. So if you can get the maximum positive bit to that, and you do it with sports too. Like when we host the Olympics, you would just tweet it. Every athlete that won a medal, because who doesn't want to get a tweet from the leader of the country saying, like, you know, job well done.
Yeah.
But then you have to realize it does come back the other way as well.
Do you ever get sick of athletes saying no personal questions?
I think it's now kind of given, but you never get tired of saying it because you know that if you don't, then it will get asked.
See, the best thing, I'm only saying that because once, Prescott, I think it was the Mandarin Oriental, when, you know, when Britney and Justin was at its height and they were about, had they split up, had they not? And there was a big press conference there, and I'd never been to one of these. It was about 2001. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. I wasn't one of the showbiz reporters. They were there being all cool in the corner somewhere in their little cabal. And it was, we'd been told, no personal questions about Justin, nothing at all. So it has to be about Crossroads, I think the film was, something that didn't really work particularly well. And it was like, the last question, please. And I put my hand up. And actually, no, someone from the Sun put the hand up and said, and they had this big arch question, Brittany, do you ever get tired of being Brittany? And she just sort of looked at him. And then the next question. And I put my hand up and said, you said that you were doing a film about being in an intense relationship. Are you in an intense relationship now? And she said, no. And then that went around the world and she split up with Justin.
That was you?
Yeah, that was me.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
No personal questions. I would have applauded that.
No personal.
I wouldn't have got in trouble for that because it was like, that's not personal. I think,
not
you know.
But no, but it is like the political equivalent of that is like, say the Chinese leader comes to town and then you deal with the Chinese, your Chinese counterpart, and they're like, we would like to do media, but we will not talk about this, 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 and this. And I'm like, well, you're in the wrong fucking country. Guess what? I can no more tell them what the this, this, and this is, but yeah, you're welcome to go try.
There's nothing the Hacks and Flacks team enjoy more after a lively record than relaxing with a delicious beer. And as we're a generous bunch, we want you to get in on that action. And so we're offering you the chance of grabbing a free case of craft ales from Beer 52. Yes, you can claim a free case of exceptional beers by simply going to www.beer52.com/hacks and cover the meagre. There's nothing the Hacks and Flacks team enjoy more after a lively record than relaxing with a delicious beer. And as we're a generous bunch, we want you to get in on that action. And so we're offering you the chance of grabbing a free case of craft ales from Beer 52. Yes, you can claim a free case of exceptional beers by simply going to www.beer52.com/hacks and cover the meagre postage costs of £5.95 to claim your free case now. Each month, Beer 52 send their members a case of unique and varied beers from a different part of the world, which includes their ever-insightful Ferment magazine, where you can learn about the breweries, regions and the wonderful world of beer whilst enjoying a phenomenal selection of fresh and tasty craft ales. And as fellow newshounds, I'm sure you'll love learning what's new in beer as much as we do. And there's also a couple of delicious snacks to enjoy too. Also, if dark beer is not your thing, you can choose the light-only case. And even if, after all that, you're still unsatisfied, you can simply pause or cancel any time. So why not join us for a drink and sip along while you listen to the next episode of Hacks and Flacks by going to www.beer52.com/hacks to claim your free case now. That's beer52.com/hacks. Cheers.
If there's one thing that every hack and flack can agree about, it's that in a country of 330 million people, it's incredible that the race for the White House is again coming down to a battle between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. I'm Simon Marks, veteran Washington correspondent for a whole array of global broadcasters, and I hope you'll check out my podcast, Simon Marks Reporting, for regular updates on all aspects of life in America. That's Simon Marks Reporting, wherever you get your podcasts.
You said you're not a crisis PR. You wouldn't label yourself as a crisis PR company. But most people would assume that that's when PR comes into its own. I mean, if you've got somebody lovely like Holly Willoughby and, you know, Harry Styles, what do they need? Their PR is already done absolutely. By them being lovely people, isn't it? So what is it you do?
No, we don't market ourselves as crisis, but we do do it.
Right.
So I think, like I said, we take on people because we respect and think what they're doing is exciting. And when they inevitably get into crisis, and the nicest people, no matter how nice you are, there will always be something that pops up. We're there to help and get involved and help them out. But I think, like I said, if you suddenly market yourself as being the crisis people, then people go, oh, they've got something going on there. You know, what's going on? You know, they've hired Doorbell to do their crisis. There must be something there that they're trying to protect them with. Whereas for us, these are good people that inevitably will find themselves in difficult situations, and we're more than happy to help them get out of it.
Or how do people do difficult things to them, right? Yeah. Like it's a catty world out there too. Especially if somebody wants to beef with you and they want to pick a fight over something. Okay, I guess we'll do that, but you'll need some help with that.
Is it the case in most PR situations that things die down, that they blow over, that sometimes doing nothing and saying nothing is actually the best thing to do rather than PR coming out with a statement?
I think every situation is different. And you have to look at what's in front of you and find out all the details before you make a decision on what you're going to do. But I've very rarely seen a situation where you say nothing and let it blow over. And when I have seen that in other places, I think it has been to their detriment, and that it's always comes back around and people think you never address this.
Right.
And I think it's really important to, I always see PR in the same way that you would see a relationship in the playground or with friends. If someone did something and they'd never said anything about it, you'd always be, when you'd be going around to theirs for drinks or dinner, you'd be thinking, you know, they've still never addressed that.
And this is where you have your own platform, right? Like, you can address it in exactly the way you want it, at least in that first go around. So why wouldn't you do that? Look, the calculations changed. It has to. If journalists rang you up and you knew that they did these kind of stories and that you were in their crosshairs and they would do it, and you could either be in the story without your side or you know, you knew that was an easier, more kind of linear calculator, straightforward calculation. Now it's what Rich was saying earlier. You have this stuff that's burbling around out there somewhere in the internet. And it could be because then a journalist finds it on a Sunday paper who needs a story and then decides they're going to put this in. And it's just harder to do now.
I wanted to come to you on this because you were talking right at the beginning about, you know, forming good relationships with PR. But at times of crisis, you are in direct odds with them because they're saying, look, you know, we're mates, ha ha ha, let's not put this in the paper. And you're, as a journalist, you're going, I've got to. So how do you still hold true to being a journalist and keep those relationships?
It's just common sense, I think, really. You know, as long as you're not threatening people and, you know, and offering sexual favours.
But you'll piss people off.
No, you do, don't you? But as long as you're doing it, you know, in the correct way, that they know you've got a job to do. That's why they're in the job they're in, you know, and that's why we've met, you know, because they're in the job. We didn't meet because we'd grown up together and we went to the same school or anything like that. So I think you've just got to understand that it is, you know, I'm in my business, you're in your business, and it is business. That's all it is.
But does it not create resentment?
Well, I'm sure it can from time to time, but then that's not, you know, if that's what
you're don't hate the player, the game.
I'm going to need to go back to someone like Richard again and again. So I'm going to calculate that at some point I'm going to need him again for something else, and it might
so
be
would
a very
you
nice
not
thing.
Print to keep
no,
that
no, I don't
that
think,
relationship
no,
going
no I wouldn't but I think
if it's again, a story it's a story and people like us know that
you
if
know
it's
what a story
it's a story.
I'd agree with that. I'd say, you know, it's a professional relationship which is built on respect, and I think there wouldn't be a case of saying, you know, I like you, so I'm not going to do this. I don't really have a... There may have been a situation which is a lighter story, which you may have got away with something like that. But I think I understand and respect when there's a story that is you know, undeniable, it's going to get told. And my job is to make sure that it's being told in a way that feels fair.
Have you ever asked somebody not to put something in the paper?
Yes, absolutely. I think things that you feel are, again, where it's come from somewhere that feels, in this increasingly crazy world with Twitter, where you think, how is this a story? There are people out there who the media just want content for those particular people, those particular artists, you know, high profile people.
But to me, that is your job to tell me not to put it in there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there was no point in you existing in many ways.
But it will be that you can have days where it'll be like day in, day out. It's like, we just want stories, no matter what it is. And we were talking the other day about a particular online news outlet that will run a story. Once they realize you're getting the engagement, a major engagement on that story, it's like, what else can we get on this artist? What else? Yeah. No matter what it is.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, isn't it, Rich? I mean, before you had a defined space, right? You only had so many pages in a paper. Now you have online.
Yeah.
And the reward, your advertisers for the printed product didn't correlate to any one piece of content that you had in there. But online now, everybody has the dashboard in the newsroom and knows.
There's a commercial aspect to it.
If I write about this, even if it's just random person tweets, you know, I was so-and-so's love child. Well, I need to investigate that. Or they claims. And, you know, they'll go with a lot less.
Does that mean
it doesn't
like you two
to
can charge more then? No, there's more outlets.
if only, Mick. If
yeah,
only.
Right.
But we don't do it.
You
for
wait
the
till
money.
Those deep fakes get going. Then you'll be you
say that, but that's the next frontier,
it
right?
Is.
Like this AI can imitate your clients, and it's then where, oh my god, you know.
Then what do you do?
You appoint an AI.
But this is where the human relationship really does matter.
We've been approached by a few people who have software that can tell what an AI, you know, image, video is compared to the real thing. And I think you're going to increasingly be relying on the sort of data tools to be able to understand and verify those sort of things. Brave new world.
What's it like when a client, and this will go for both of you, you know, makes that call late at night in a panic because they've said something, they've done something, they've been seen somewhere. What's your first statement to them? What do you say?
I'm always very methodical about it. Okay. And usually in a situation will be probably a little bit of panic from their side. And it'll be okay. Just I need to know all the details. What happened? Find out everything that happened and find out where you stand effectively. And then you can go away and start formulating a plan on how you tackle it. And whether it needs to be mea culpa or hold on a minute, no, this is not your fault. This is, we need to kind of put this on this particular party who it's their responsibility to kind of to come in and deal with this particular, because sometimes it's not them. It's actually connected to them, but it's not them. And they call up in a panic going, oh, this just happened. It's like, this isn't your fight. So it's making sure you know all the details, and then from that plan you can then work out where you're going.
So so rather than just rushing to put out a statement.
Definitely, yeah. I think it's finding out all of the information first, because if you're missing a little bit of information, that could change everything. Mm-hmm. And it's so important to get all of the information. And I've been there before. I've been there late night, going to bed and getting on the call and going, right, okay, what we got? Getting the notepad out. I've been sitting down to a film and suddenly this just happened. We need to make a statement in sort of 15 minutes. Can you put it together?
Oh,
and having to do it there, you know, show my age now, but on my BlackBerry. The
best tool for writing statements,
absolutely,
by the way.
You know.
Fuck these iPhones. Give me a good old keyboard. Like, I would edit speeches and press releases on that thing. It was so good. Canadian technology, by the way. Didn't really see the iPhone coming, did it? But yeah, I think that, and the thing too, that the incoming, because you understand, unless you've ever been in the Klieg lights for something like this, it is a very uncomfortable feeling. So the last thing you ever want to do is reflect that back to your client. You got to be the one that goes, okay, tell me what happened. And it is, most of the time in my experience, it's just they want to see someone not freak out and tell them that everything's going to be all right. And that's where the relationship with your client is so important, because they have to trust you implicitly and to be able to share all
that
stuff of like, yeah, I was lippy. I was gobby in that, you know, and I I did cross the line, and we are going to have to say something about this.
But what about 5 days later when everything isn't, and to your best efforts, everything isn't all right? How does that relationship carry on after that?
Then you kill them and drop them as a client.
No. Because you can't solve every crisis, can you, you two? That's the thing.
Mm. No, but you can't take it personally either. I mean sometimes if somebody's done something really dumb, you know that it's going to be a long way back, and it could be that you have to go away for months before you can kind of think about getting a fresh look in on something.
The worst, I think, is when you see somebody who hasn't done something wrong getting bad PR.
We've all done something wrong.
I won't mention names. Who do we think is the most skittish? Showbiz people or showbiz for ugly people?
Politicians and celebrities are very, I imagine, similar in some respects. And A, they hate being kicked for the most part. And quite a few of them on the political side anyway, because that's where most of my experience is, feel they get treated unfairly. And it's always, you know, sometimes you just have to look them in the eye and go, look, you deserve this kicking. So I'm not going to tell you that what you did didn't stink. It did, you know. And I wouldn't be doing you a service by saying that the world's out against you. Like, that's what they say. It's my job to get around that and fix that. And I'm not going to fix it by telling you that you're a saint if you've been a sinner.
Yeah.
Did you want to be in rock and roll or did you want to be in PR?
I didn't know what PR was at all. Yeah. I did my degree in economic history.
I did that was mine as well.
Really?
Yeah.
It really helped
good,
you both.
Good solid grounding.
That McCartney interview really helped. Absolutely nothing.
Before we go, I thought it would be fun to throw a couple of hypothetical PR situations your way and see how you, Andrew and Richard, save the day. Mick, you have to decide if you're buying this BS, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Can we phone a friend?
Let's start. A singer's squeaky clean image has been tarnished by having an extramarital drug-fueled romp. I love the word romp. With hookers. What do you do to rebuild their reputation?
But this is all true. This actually did happen, right?
Obviously.
I always feel bad that bonking doesn't happen in newspapers anymore.
Oh, I love that word, bonking. One of my favourites. Okay.
The 10 bonker night star.
Right, so you've had that panic call. There's photographs.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I'd say, like I said earlier, I think knowing, you know, there's a lot of planning and understanding that needs to go into these.
Well, if you're going to have romps with hookers,
I think there's probably a lot of information behind that statement, which is quite a short statement, that would have to be delved into to find out exactly what's gone on. So the first thing is obviously to find out exactly what's happened. And I think, again, as I said before, great believer in mea culpa, you know, just I screwed up. You know, and a heartfelt, full apology.
Screwed something.
The same thing, yeah. And but at the same time, also showing that, you know, if that person was in a relationship, etc., making sure that over time, again, this sounds so sort of
like a therapist.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's just because it happens. So this happens over a period of months where you're going through these sort of things. But I'm looking at a hypothetical situation that I'm not attached to directly. So I'm just giving you a very,
it's difficult to do.
To be clear,
yeah.
Let's say politician. Caught with hookers.
Yeah,
not for the first time.
I think you have to work from the premise that people understand that people are flawed, and I think that can work in your favor. And that, to Rich's point, if you do get a mea culpa and a apology, I think people are forgiving. And there's always a pain behind a decision to do something like that. There's always a human element, a flaw. Why are you laughing at me? But that does do this thing. So it depends if somebody wants to get into that. A bit about it, not to excuse it. And you know, you've had the great I'm going to rehab world tour stuff, which,
sure.
I mean, if people need that help, they need that help. But there is no substitute from saying it was a very dumb thing to do. And I've been in a situation where you write a statement that is like, it has to be as direct as you can be, because you cannot dance around the fact that what they have done is wrong. And the second that an audience, or Mick in this case, detects a caveat, a weasel word, the classic, not then it's dead in the water, and then you've done the bad thing.
But if I've already paid the hooker £500,000 to tell me everything,
well, anyway.
So this is three paragraphs, 10 piles in, so that's all I need. Thanks very much.
So, yeah, that's what I was going to say. So you're the you've just
well, they become slightly redundant at that point.
Well, no, but we've already sussed out that they did, in fact, romp. with hookers.
And but that, as Richard that, says, I imagine then he has to go off and just try and stop these people from doing something stupid. You know, you got to look after them properly. You know, that's it's more than
or
just...
Or you can lean and like, I mean, but they're squeaky clean, right? Yeah. So this isn't like Pete Doherty, like having drug fill in and be, okay, that's Wednesday. Okay, thank you.
I like to believe that humans believe in redemption as well. So I think if they stop and say, you know what, I screwed up. Here's my apology, full apology. You take the flak, you know, and then if you show through action that you are redeeming yourself, then I think everyone likes to see that.
Yeah,
and,
are the public forgiving enough these days? They're very judgmental.
Again, I think going back to the elasticity thing, in terms of how long it takes, depends on what people think of you as a person. If they think you're a good person, you made a mistake, it's probably quite quick.
And again, the British public, they do like those redemption stories. They do like
everybody does. I think that was my point, is that people realize that people are human, people realize that people make mistakes, if they put their hand up for that mistake, what you don't want to do is do the mistake and then do the non-apology because it looks like you're being deceitful both ways. And then why is anybody going to listen to you? For God's sake, don't give the non-apology and then show up at the family home the next day and drag your missus out or your mister out in front of the cameras and go, look at us and how happy we are. And like, people can see through that kind of stuff.
Like, look how many times Gaza came back, you know.
Because people knew that he was, even like with somebody like Kanye, there is a deep issue there that people get that all this stuff that's going on in his life is producing this kind of stuff. And if he could get a grip on it, he would get a grip on it.
Mm-hmm. And I just say one last thing on that, actually, that, you know, obviously we're, you know, cancel culture, which is obviously a big thing at the moment. I don't like the onset of the idea or the phrase apologize rather than ask permission. And I think this is something that gets used a lot. And I think it unfortunately belittles people who do need to make a genuine apology. Because I think the reason this cancel culture thing does pervade for a lot of reasons is because people don't feel, they feel like, oh, they're apologizing. They knew what they were doing. They're just apologizing to get themselves out of this. And I think we're in that situation telling people they've got to apologize and it's not being accepted. And you think, come on. Like, this is genuine. This person is trying to make amends. They screwed up. Give them a break.
What about apologising for something they haven't done? Because that's the...
Well, no, going back to what you were saying earlier about are there some times when, you know, when I say, you know, apologise, I'm a great believer in coming in and saying this. There's some things that, the stories that pop up and you think, oh, I'm sorry, but we're not engaging with that. That is absolutely ludicrous. We're not even going to give that the time of day. So you definitely don't legitimise stories by then commenting. So we're not commenting on every single thing that's coming through. So I just think when it's significant and it's something you think, this needs to be addressed, you know, in the same way I was talking about friends amongst friends, if there's little things that happen, you don't hold it against them. If there's something major that you feel this needs to be tied up, that requires an apology.
If you had clients that were Chris Rock and Will Smith, how would you have dealt with that slap and the fallout?
Chris Rock first. I think that's what people expect from Chris Rock. I think he crosses the line. He's a comedian. I think actually he increased his ticket sales for his tour.
I saw him on that tour about 3 weeks later. Yeah. And he's like, I'm not going to get into this. You have to wait for the Netflix special.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah. Okay. I love Will Smith. I grew up on, you know, Fresh Prince. And, you know.
Can he ever come back?
Well, he kind of already has, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, his apology was not...
It wasn't.
Not.
I think that's what some people felt. It didn't go far enough. And I think that, again, goes back to, if you're going to apologise, you've got to own it. There can't be any excuses. Or this, by the way, this is why it happened. If someone's doing this, then of course you're going to do that. Right. It's got to be like, I was in the wrong. I'm not saying anything.
No, I'm an adult. I know I would never tell my kids that two wrongs make a right. So what, he made a joke about my wife. That's not worth violence. And I was stupid. You know, sorry. That's a bad example for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people saying that emancipation, had that not happened, would have done so much better. But the Academy just completely turned away from him.
Is there a difference between your American clients and the British clients as to how they react to the name of the company, Doorbell?
Well, this, you know what? You bring up an interesting point, Nick. When Stu and I were coming up with a name, and I said, Stu, I've got a great name, you know, and we laughed and said, no, we've got to come up with something serious, you know. And then we just came back to it. And when the American clients come in and they say, what's a doorbell? Well, actually, you pronounce it door in over here, not da. So over there, they said doorbell is a doorbell, not a da bell.
So it's your attention.
Very American
cousins. That doesn't quite work.
At the door.
So, and then I do get introduced as Richard Dar. Yeah. This is the Dar in Dial.
Do you have a video one or do you have an analog doorbell at home?
We've just got a video one.
Ah, there you go.
Listen,
moving with the times.
At the risk of getting some bad PR, I've got to say that that's all we've got time for today. Thanks very much indeed to Mick Booker, Andrew McDougall. And
why'd you have to butcher my name?
Because it's fun. And Richard Dawes, thank you very much indeed for coming in. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time for more Hacks and Flacks. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petri Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.